when the world financial crisis hits, everything goes down. Everything crashes. The only thing that's not going down during a flight to safety is the US dollar. The institutions are coming and someone needs to give them the data, and that can be Bloomberg or Morningstar. Why not represent this data from the Bitcoin ethos? We hate fiat, but I'm also practical. It's like, what is your pain tolerance? Oh my gosh, so philosophical. I try to think outside the box. First, is this problem even the right problem? And what if this problem is not even the problem? Feeling my body and my heart and all this stuff, and I didn't think much of it until I got to meet him. I mean, there's been so many deaths, so I'm like, which one shall I talk about? When you have these large concentrations of Bitcoin, they can be nationalized by governments. Hey, the US government's done it before. History can repeat again.
Tell me about the last time you panicked during a crash.
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin, Willie. I'm excited to talk to you about Bitcoin and beyond. But first, let's get to know you better with my 21 takes on you. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Who or what do you watch closely?
Wow. There's so much going on in this industry. I don't have any rules about what to watch. Bitcoin's been the thing that, you know, I follow my curiosity. And so I always believe if you're following that, you're going to dig in and find stuff that is unique, with a unique perspective. And this cycle, it's been very much the Bitcoin treasury companies. I think there's a lot of learnings there for myself because I'm more of a technologist. Also, zooming out from the bigger picture, I go down deep sort of thought rabbit holes and through conversations. And the other thing has been this zoom out of the recent years of looking at where we sit in this long view across 10,000 years and what difference does this technology make. So I like that sort of really zoomed in picture, is what's happening in the cycle, what's different about it from like 4 years ago versus, you know, 10,000 years of monetary progress, and to get some perspective.
What are your thoughts on trying to improve governments?
Governments, there's a overriding need, it seems, within the government to, you know, control, tax, overspend. We talk about separation of money and state, and that was always a sort of abstract concept. I didn't really know what it meant. And I think as Bitcoiners, we really understand what that means, that governments always try to buy our votes by promising things that it cannot afford, and then they overspend, and then they print money to get themselves out of the deficit. Unless you can tax, which is always unpopular, you can do the hidden tax. So what we end up with is the poorest of society and the middle class having their wealth stolen from them as their currency is debasing. And you have to absolutely understand markets and know investments and all the stuff to shelter yourself from having your wealth stolen from you. And so, I mean, Bitcoin at its basic level is the separation of money and state, meaning that let's stop the working class to actually be sheltered from this dynamic and in this like road to poverty. So I think that it might not be seen as improving government, but I think if you were to think of the base reason why government exists, which is to serve the people, this is a technology that keeps governments honest. And I think that a lot of Bitcoiners in the industry here, that's the kind of North Star that we head for, is to create a society that has a government, or the way in which the government works is much more transparent and honest.
Great. Most misunderstood chart?
Oh, gosh. I mean, for a chart to be misunderstood, it has to be popular. Within crypto, I think the stock to flow is probably the chart that's most misunderstood. I mean, we can talk about like how it's a model and all models break. I think it's a good guidance using like the scarcity of an asset. But I think most people understand that this model will break, because when the Bitcoin emissions go to zero, then the denominator is zero and then the formula breaks.
How can someone free themselves from their limitations?
Oh, okay. What's that? What's the movie called? Is it the Jim Carrey movie, Yes Men? Or in this movie, Jim Carrey, you know, he's going through all this crap in his life, and then he decides, I'm going to make this rule. Hmm. I'm going to say yes to everything that comes my way. Right? And I think it's something like this, is that it's not saying yes to everything. If it's something that scares you, go and do it.
Uh-huh.
And you keep doing that, your envelope of the reality, it will expand, because there's so much we say no to in our lives. So, you know, when I was very young, I was very, I still am introvert, somewhat depressed, somewhat like in a tiny little world. And I think that was my North Star at the time, is like, oh, I'm scared of doing this, so I have to force myself to do it. And then before long, all these things opened up. Life looked wonderful. And you just keep doing it, you know, as a general practice. And I think that's the path, right? The fear is what keeps us from doing great things.
What's a quiet win that mattered more than any headline?
The answer to that, I think, is very personal to everybody.
Yeah.
And generally, it's based on things like emotion and spirit and identity. And usually, it centers around things that are around family and love and friendship and relationships. In my life, you know, we have children now, and I think the quiet wins are all the times that I get to spend with these kids that are like, they're going to be, you know, this moment's going to be gone tomorrow, because, you know, we've got a 4-year-old, 1.5-year-old, you know, they're going to change just like that. And so those are the quiet wins when, you know, we have time in the family to be there. I mean, it's so enriching.
What are the benefits of walking away?
I mean, there's benefits in staying as well as walking away. I walk away a lot because, you know, there's two types of lives, right? There's the life that is a planned life, which it's a life that maybe I'll get this degree, maybe I'll go into a job, maybe I'll you know, rise up in the company. Maybe I'll buy a house. I want this dream house. I want this level of wealth. I want that. You know, there's that world, and it's somewhat structured, a lot structured. And then there's this world, you know, a wise man once said to me, who the hell are you to think you know how big this world is? This world is infinite with possibilities, you know. And so why do you want to have all these preconceived ideas of the futures for yourself when it's infinite and it's amazing, it's mysterious? And so the other path involves things like doing the things that scare you. It involves the things like walking away from your safe little life and seeing what comes your way. And so I walked away a few years back after having, you know, huge, you know, podcast visibility. And I tend to walk away in the bear markets because there's other things to focus on. But also that was the time we started our family, and I wasn't walking away. I was walking towards something, you know, to spend some time in this, you know, they're only young in a very short amount of time, and time's the most precious thing. But I'm not afraid of walking away from things because there's something else, even bigger or better or a new learning or a new adventure. And I really admire the people that have, you know, climbed a mountain, they're nearly at the peak, and they realize they're not climbing the right mountain and you feel it and you know that it's going to be a grind to get to the top because your heart's not in it anymore, because you know this was not the thing that lights you up. Maybe you thought it was what you wanted, and for you to have clarity when you're almost there, and then you say you see the other mountain to climb and you just go for it. I think deep down inside, the person you are, and you know that's right for you, and you just do it. I think I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah. What drives the way you make decisions?
There's decisions and there's these decisions, right? There's logical business decisions, and then there's like heart and soul decisions. When I'm looking at problem solving decisions, I try to think outside the box. First, is this problem even the right problem? And what if this problem is not even the problem? And just zoom out from a bit more. A lot of these things are quite straightforward, I think. They're like, they just require creativity and good execution. The sort of heart and soul problems that, like, you know, maybe am I going in the right direction, that sort of thing. I don't think it comes from the head. I think it comes from your gut feel and instincts and a check-in on your body.
Do you trust more your intuition or your reason?
Both. And the intuition side of things is I wouldn't do it immediately. Like, I'm going to do that. You just keep checking in. I use my mind a lot, but also I check in on the body and how much energy is in the system and try to sort of balance the two.
If the IRS were a person, how would you describe it?
You know, that saying, if you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Mm-hmm.
They're a tool. They're tools that hammer everyone for tax collection. I think of it as part of the machinery of the US government, and that's given a directive, and these guys do their job. We can talk about, is what they do constitutional and the bigger picture things. You know, we can talk about the morality, how the US government never had taxes on the people, income taxes on the people, that income taxes came into being to fund a war, and that was never, you know, repealed. There's all these things, but the IRS is a hammer doing its job. And so when we talk about the IRS, it's not really the IRS that's the issue. It's actually the people that are making the rules and the laws, and the people itself standing up for the Constitution.
What metric still gives you chills when it flashes?
I don't think I've ever had the chills from a metric. I've definitely had excitement going, wow, this thing's going to tell me something. And that's like a eureka moment. You should be careful if you get that too. because the metrics are really important. They look quite promising. You'll get that excitement, but also you could be easily misled by the excitement, and you've got to see it run and work through the test of time. You know, obviously I'm building metrics and I'm building models on things, and all models are going to break and they're prone to error. And so never chills. Just surprise.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's something you never talk about but wish I would ask?
I don't really get that because I get asked a lot of questions and usually I can move the question towards what I want to talk about. So, and that changes depending on the latest thing I'm fascinated with. You know, the latest thing I've been fascinated with is, what is money?
Okay.
All right. Because it sounds really boring. And as Bitcoiners, we look at that very closely, and it's only dawned on me that no one realizes what money is. Only a few, right? Bitcoin is. No, actually, Bitcoin's not digital gold. Money is not gold. Money is an abstract concept. It was really a formalization of something that's natural to all of us, that I do you a favor and you're indebted to me and you do me a favor. And that's what society, communities, nation states, They're all based on this fundamental, and somewhere along the line, it got formalized. We find that in Sumerian records, the church is used to keep a track of these favors, and the earliest form of money was actually a ledger tracking debt. Social debt became monetary debt. And who's going to write in that ledger? Well, it turned out that we've got to stop people from cheating the ledger. So the best way to secure this ledger, which is money, is with a lump of gold or silver, which is very hard to dig out of the ground and make more of and flood the market with. It had to have these properties that were durable over time, divisible, fungible. You know, these are the properties we've been taught by the scholars and our teachers, that this was money and this was a tool to barter with. But money is actually a ledger, and there's only two properties that money needs to have, and that is it needs to be accepted by everyone and it needs to be secure. And so it's been 16 years of Bitcoin, and it's only now that I realize Bitcoin is money, but I understand that it's money, that it is a ledger. Is it divisible? It's a ledger, right? Is it fungible? It's a ledger. Is it durable? It's a ledger that sits in the cloud, and the fundamental reason we have digital is because it's durable. It doesn't get clouded by analog noise. The only things that really matter are acceptability, and we used to say scarcity, but that's not actually the case. It's secure from someone diddling the books. And so how do you do that in a digital world? You need a lot of energy to diddle the books. And it just turns out energy is the only way you can secure a ledger if you look forward the next 10,000 years. Because if you're going to secure money with atoms, which is gold and silver, it's not going to be scarce as technology goes to the moon. Literally, when we get off this planet, there's all of the solar system worth of gold atoms and silver atoms to mine. You can secure it like present day with social consensus, which is trust me, bro. The central bank is trusted. Some may disagree, but for the most part, society trusts that these guys can write into the ledger and debase, and they're doing the best for society. That's paperizing over a liquidity crisis, and that'll end, and it always has. It's not honest. So we're going to move into a future money, and it can only be secured by energy, because energy is the only form of consensus mechanism that scales with infinite technology, because we measure technology by how much energy that technology level uses. So that'll work until forever. Yeah. So that's money, and it's taken me 16 years of Bitcoin being around and me being, in the space for 12 years to realize, oh my gosh, we don't know what money is. This is what money is. This is what the evidence points to. And when Peter Schiff comes on his platform and says it has no intrinsic value, it's a ledger. It has no industrial value. Well, you don't want industrial value. It's a ledger, and you're going to pollute the accuracy of that ledger when they discover, industrial uses here and there, and it creates demands and distortions in that ledger. That's not what you want. You want a pure ledger. You want it to sit in the cloud. You want it secured by energy. Yeah, that's the thing right now for me.
Why is it important to challenge our own beliefs?
It's, when I'm thinking that when we are born and we're kids, we don't have strong beliefs, and we adapt and we learn, and the world is open. And the thing about beliefs are almost always they'll be wrong. And so beliefs can lead you astray from finding the truth. And if you look at the kind of life you want to live, you can maybe look at older people because I've seen patterns again and again and again, versus the young people who may not have the life experience, but they don't have calcified beliefs. And then you see people that are old, then there's the light in the eyes, and they hang around younger people, try and understand the world they live in. I think these are the people that don't have too calcified beliefs, and they stay young, and life becomes a joy. I'd say that. And most beliefs are wrong. Yeah.
Is there a part of yourself you had to let die to keep going?
Oh my gosh, so philosophical. I think we die every day, and every day is different. And so I think that over a long term, absolutely.
Which would be that part for you?
Many, many deaths. Many deaths. Is this specific to myself?
To you, yeah. This is what 21 takes on you.
21 takes on me. I mean, there's been so many deaths. I'm like, which one shall I talk about? I'll tell you what, more sort of, you know, on the surface death, like in a way, mm-hmm. that I think many may relate to is I'm from a Chinese family, right? I was born in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. I was raised in New Zealand. I had Chinese parents that were very much instilling education, learn. We came from a very, very poor family. So I can see this standard kind of thing you see with parents is they want for you the best thing possible, and they want you to take the safe path, right? And so if I was to think about myself going through school, university, and then getting an engineering job, I was pretty square. I was pretty on the rails of what my parents wanted for me. And at a certain point, I knew what lit me up, right? What lit me up was technology. And I'm designing, you know, medical equipment. Great, I'm an engineer. I like that. It's an interesting job. But what really lit me up was mobile tech. At the time, I dabbled with computers when I was young. And for the life of me, I wanted to do that. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I was already being asked to do websites for these tech startups. And I, by the way, I'd just done my big OE. You do this as a Kiwi, the big overseas experience. So I was like done a big spend up to see the world. And that actually opened up the opportunity to talk to these, you know, you might call them tech startups and stuff like that. And I'm back in New Zealand in my old job to get my cash back again. And I don't have a lot of money. And, you know, I've got debts as well. And I'm going, I know if I do this, I'm never coming back to engineering. And I was like, stay in this. Been 5 years in university. Now maybe 6 years as an engineer. And I'm like, screw it, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I don't know where my next paycheck will come from. It's probably the biggest decision in my 20s. I don't know if you call that a death, but that was definitely an old part of me and that way of thinking of myself as the engineer. And then I had to become this other person. And that was the start of a huge journey. Actually, yeah. That was when the whole world opened up for me. The first thing was I didn't have to go through rush hour to commute to work. And I was like, I used to speak an hour and a half in rush hour there and back, you know, like, and so there was all these amazing liberties and then amazing opportunities because there's no boss telling you what to do. You have to think for yourself. And so, I mean, that's where Birth of a New Person came out of. It was like, wake up, what are you going to do tomorrow? Or like, what are you going to do in your business? And so that's probably a very pivotal part in my life in terms of a person, an old part of me dying and something new. I don't think of things as dying as something new coming out that you never saw before.
What did your family, your parents think about it?
Well, my parents had passed at that point. And so I'd like to think that they'd be supportive, really. I think they would have. I probably would have told him, I would have framed it in a way that sounded obviously the right path. Yeah.
When was the last time Bitcoin surprised you?
Early in my journey, they were the biggest surprises, right? They were the biggest surprises because you know nothing to start with. And probably the one that I think most was when I started trying to figure out and answer the questions myself. How quickly is this Bitcoin growing by? And what surprised me that back then, every 11 months, actually, the user base was doubling. And then, of course, once you get these points on a chart, you can then extrapolate the curve. And it's like, wow, we're going to have 1 billion people using this. And, you know, I think back then it was pointing towards around now, around these years ahead, around 2025 to 2030. Actually, it was because it's growing so quickly. Around 2025, we have 1 billion people. Currently, it's about 500 million people using Bitcoin. And so the next, let's call it another 4 years or so, it's growing less fast at the moment.
Why do you think it's growing less fast at the moment?
In terms of sheer number of people, it's absolutely insane. But it's, if you were to look at the first month when Bitcoin was first released, I think the first month there was 100 people using it, up from one person, 100x'd in 30 days. And then it went to 1,000 the following month. These were the numbers, right? So it's insanely fast at the beginning. And then you're going to get into your stride and it slows down a bit. And then you move at that pace. And it's always an adoption S-curve. And so if you were to look at that, I think we were going to settle into a steady, almost linear growth of the percentage of the population being adopted, and then it starts to taper off. So the S curve is you hockey stick up, there's almost a straightish portion, and then it sort of curves and rolls over as you reach close to the ceiling of 100%. So, I mean, for now, it's something to behold, I would say. Like between the move from 500 million to 1 billion people using Bitcoin is like 1/8 of the world population is pretty insane. And that's surprising to me. We kind of think we're early, which we are. Actually, we're early in terms of the money being stored in it. There's only $1 trillion of capital stored in this network, even though there's a $2 trillion plus market cap. Whereas there's 900 trillion of wealth assets out there. So it's very early in the amount of capital coming in. I guess the rich guys are conservative and they're going to come in last. But in terms of the people using it, needing it, learning about it, that's growing very quickly. Yeah. And that's surprising.
What's the worst piece of advice you've ever followed?
Ever followed? My gosh. Right. I mean, I don't know. How many people follow advice, you know?
I do.
Do you?
I follow plenty of advice.
I don't really follow advice much. If it resonates, okay. Like it goes, yeah, that's good. Then it's like a suggestion that you go, oh, I never thought about that. That is absolutely right. And that's, you're really following yourself because you've vetted it. There is definitely times where I've bought into an investment without understanding it. Then often that might come from advice, you know, you should buy this because it's going to go to the moon or something. Those are the times that's like blindly following. You know, if we're going to talk about, I'm going to change the question into talking about advice. I think advice is great because it's a suggestion on how to think about something. If it's, you should do this because I've looked at it and it looks great and it's so convoluted, you don't have the time and you're like, and you just say, all right, I'll put some investment in that. That's usually the worst. So I try not to do that much these days. Advice, life advice, I think it's always vetted by myself.
I remember during the COVID, someone advised me to buy gold and I did.
I don't know if that's advice. Maybe it's the herd. That actually led me astray.
Go on.
Because, like, talking about COVID, yes. Right, I sold Bitcoin into that crash.
Okay.
Because it wasn't clear to me how long it would take for us to get out of this. And mm-hmm. it wasn't clear to me just the impact that what the Fed was doing and dumping so much liquidity into the market and it all bounced. You know, this is what, 5 years later of learning of what, you know, TradFi does in response and so forth. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, wow, I used to have everything in Bitcoin and I had like no more than 2 months runway in fiat to pay for expenses. Mm-hmm. And I sold Bitcoin during that dump to finance a runway out to 2 years. You know, it was a learning because I don't know if it was advice, but it was a wrong thinking for me because mm-hmm. it's too greedy as well. You want everything in. The practical reality is I live in a fiat world and I need fiat to pay for things. And so at that point, I'm like, always going to have fiat as a runway of 2 years. So Bitcoin crashes, who cares? Don't need to sell, you know. If anything, I might be tempted to buy with a bit of the runway. And that's only gotten bigger as, you know, with the family and so forth. The buffering is increased. And so we hate fiat, but I'm also practical. There is a need right now, because we're in a fiat world, to have some sort of buffer from, and it's an emotional buffer, right? It's like, what is your pain tolerance? If you're like insane and you love risk, like, you know, someone who's in a wingsuit that likes to fly through holes in mountains, well, maybe you can go all in, you know, find the right thing for yourself. Being in the industry, I think I don't know if it was advice, but it seems like everyone's yelling, be all in, otherwise you're not a true Bitcoin or whatever. But that tolerance is different for everyone, because realistically, the hurdle rate of performance to shelter yourself from being poorer and having wealth stolen from you through debasement is 7% per annum. You only have to beat 7% per annum. That's 5% debasement per year and 2% of global GDP growth. Mm. And Bitcoin does that. It does that by miles. It's in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, sometimes even 80% per annum measured over a full cycle. So you don't need to be all in.
Yeah. Out of curiosity and, you know, to adapt it to my own needs, how big is your buffer?
I don't use the runway anymore because I'm going to be fine no matter what now. I don't like to sell my Bitcoin exposure. I might do it in a bear market because I'd like to have more exposure and have like to have more Bitcoins at the bottom of it. And my day job is to try and model these markets. And it's very obvious once we're, you know, in well and truly in a bear market. And so I would sell. So, but back to the question, I like to have enough, like let's say USD exposure, it's not dollars, it's USD exposure, such that the yield on it pays for our family's living costs. That's a whole different topic, right? Because the yield on US dollars, if it's in treasuries, are 4%, say. Potentially, you could say if you lend out your US dollars on a lending platform like DebiFi, where you've got a private key on it, like you're going to get the private key of the collateral. The borrower is going to get the private key of the collateral. It's very, very robust. Current rates right now is 12 to 14%. And if you're in that range, you've got a 12, 14% yield. For every $100,000 is in there, you're getting, let's say, $13,000 of income. That's why I look at it. I'm like, what if that income is enough to feed the family, pay for ourselves, never have to sell my Bitcoin? We run institutional fund of funds that, you know, for myself, I get 20% yield. I'm very hands-on, by the way, with that. Because as you go up the yield curve, you're going to be exposed to much more risk. and I'm very hands-on on it. And so that'll give you an idea how I look at it. I put in enough such that the yield is enough to pay for our expenses. The rest I like to put into Bitcoin exposure and invest back into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how important is music in your life?
I think less than most. Okay. Yeah, short answer. I love it, you know. I relate to the older music from the, you know, the 80s and 90s and even the 60s. Some pretty good music back in those times. I was never around in the 60s, but you got to feel, you know, just generally music, modern day music to me feels very electronic, but also I think we've gone through a period where it's been industrialized a lot.
Hmm.
And the recording studios didn't let the artists do their stuff, and they knew what sold, and it became productized. The music nowadays, I think there's a resurgence of the internet and having home studios, and I think it'd be interesting to see what's coming out of there. You know, in the old days, the rock stars used to get on stage. They would go to these crazy retreats in the middle of nowhere to just jam.
Mm.
And their studios would pay for it. And so you got these absolute artists that were flown by the money people to places they wouldn't have done themselves. And they went and created art, and some good stuff came out of that. So I like the older music. That's some of the new stuff I like. But, you know, I wouldn't say it's a big part of my life. You know, I'm not constantly listening to music. I'm constantly listening to podcasts and stuff because there's so much to learn. When if I'm going to go for a walk and go for a drive, I have an option between music or to be educated. And often I'm picking the education over the music unless I'm feeling very in the mood for some vibes, you know.
Yeah, I do that.
Yeah.
But then taking a shower and I have the Foo Fighters or Black Keys or...
The Foo Fighters.
Each album keeps surprising you.
Right,
and it's,
yeah. Yeah, it's a time.
Radiohead.
It's the time in the day to enjoy music versus the time in the day where you actually got a lot on versus those times where you can listen to music. In those times where it's getting compressed, I generally turn on a long form podcast.
I understand, me too.
Yeah, it's like a download of information. So that's probably why the music has been less, you know.
Yeah. Do you still practice your yoga?
I do a meditation practice. It comes from India. It's mm-hmm. Yoga, breath, that type of thing. Not as much as I should, let's say that. Actually, few people know, but Daniel Batten in the industry, I met him through mindfulness circles because I was so burnt out from my startup. And, you know, I exited the startup. It did well, but I'm out of the startup now, and I was like, I'm so burnt out. I think I'm going to do this body mind stuff and recharge. I'm going to, I'm going to look for a meditation practice that works for me. And actually, Daniel teaches the practice they ended up adopting, and that is very Eastern. Comes out of India, and it's probably more in the breath. Because if you look at what yoga really is it's a full stack operating system.
Mm-hmm.
The mind is the meditation side of it. There's the breath that connects the mind to the body, and then yoga is the body part. And the Western sense of it is that yoga is this thing, but it's actually just part of the stack. And then it goes to the breath, which you do in yoga. And then by the end of a yoga session, you're so meditative. But that sets you up for the meditation. And that's the full stack. And so I was doing more focus on the breath than mind, and yoga also a little bit of that.
Okay.
So, and yeah, and that works for me because my mind's so busy.
That would work for me.
The organization that was doing it, is Art of Living. It's, you know, got the whole thing with the guru, the enlightened guru, that might turn off some of the people in the West. Because the practice was so good for me, I went over to actually Bali to do due diligence on, because I heard the yogi was coming and I wanted to check out. So let's see what an enlightened master is. And I came away quite convinced.
Did you meet the guru?
Yeah, I mean, like, it was done in a 5-star hotel and in Bali, you know, it was pretty ramshackle back there. So a 5-star hotel was kind of like ordinary hotel.
Okay.
And what the thing I noticed going into, I started to feel very reflective, and I could feel like me feeling my body and my heart and all this stuff. And I didn't think much of it until I got to meet him, you know. I was starting to feel the stronger and stronger, This guy just emanated intense heart energy. It was just, yeah, it's, anyway. And then there's all these stories I could talk about. But
I don't know if you're familiar with Sadhguru.
Yes, I listened to some of his stuff, yes.
Yeah, I read a few of his books and I would love to meet him. And I think the energy probably that emanates.
Sadhguru, he's very good at explaining things. And that's the same thing with Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. He's very, very good at articulating, so it lands. Mm-hmm. He's educated, and it's really good. Because a lot of the old teachings are very, you really don't know what's being said. So
what's something you quietly track that everyone else ignores?
I don't know if I'm quiet, you know, to be honest.
You're claiming to be shy, so.
No, yes, I am introverted. But if I find something, I don't usually quietly track it. I'll say, hey, look at this. This is pretty interesting. I feel like that's my role in the industry. If I find something, I don't quietly track it. Now, I started in the industry measuring things and measuring the market and trying, and that's how I realized Bitcoin was everything. Like everything else didn't have the fundamentals. And that came through data in the charts, not from people telling me. Mm-hmm. And so that turned into on-chain analysis. This is the thing that's new. So we've got a blockchain, visible ledger, the sea of transactions are telling us stuff about investor flows and so forth. And so there's all of this stuff that's happening. And I think over time, this has evolved, because a lot of that stuff is great. It's good for narration, narrative, like the whales are buying, the old holders are selling or accumulating, the shrimps, you know, the small guys are really stacking hard. And you can see all this behavioral stuff, but a lot of that stuff is interesting, but it doesn't predict the market. And what I'm trying to do is like see where we are in the cycle, trying to figure out the probability of where the price may go. Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? Is it going to chop around sideways? The thing that I've learned, you know, because what, 4 to 5 years ago, I started the Bitcoin forecast. And that became the biggest paid publication in this space. And it was by far the biggest. And it used on-chain. And I think that was me 4 years into on-chain analysis. And that's 5 years ago now. And I realized so much of that stuff is you can be led astray. The on-chain stuff is amazing if you're looking at the right side of things. And the only things I look at now, and you might call that quietly tracking, is liquidity, which in simple terms is flows of money coming in and out of this bucket called Bitcoin. This bucket that carries money, and so does the S&P 500, so does gold. We're just flowing liquidity into these buckets. And so though that's the only game in town, like price follows liquidity. That's what I work on now, is to build the models around liquidity flows. And sure, I've got signals, but underlying that is the core model of liquidity, the best I can make it, because they're always estimates. And if anything, that's what I'm tracking. And I don't publish that chart. That is a model I use. It's a proprietary model. And you know, these other models that have a view into the core model, and you know, Swiss Block approached me, and Swiss Block are old friends. They were the guys that brought us Glassnode.
Mm-hmm.
They were powerhouse data people that gave us the on-chain data, but they've been trading these markets since 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And so that stuff got formalized into Glassnode, but behind the scenes, they are the OG traders, and they have some incredible models doing the same stuff. And so we figured we'd take these models and let's build an institutional grade publication and deliver that to the institutional world, because the institutions are coming and they're going to come in, and they are coming in, and someone needs to give them the data for it. And that can be Bloomberg or Morningstar, or it can be from within our industry. And it's us that have traded these models, understood the data and what works, what doesn't. And why not represent this data to the institutions from the Bitcoin ethos? If anything's quiet, it's like we're looking at all of the liquidity inside Bitcoin and altcoins and shitcoins and meme coins, and where's it all flowing? And also the inflows from macro and that. So from there, you get a very good picture. And it's, you know, a lot of mistakes along the way, but we're getting to a point where I think we can get expert at it. And to be an expert in anything, really expert, it'll take 15 years. So that's what we're aiming for. Bitcoin's 16 years old right now, but the people that came in to look at the markets and the data behind it, probably only 10 years old now.
What's the mistake you made that taught you the most?
We call them tuition fees in the industry. I can't think of single one mistake. There's been a lot of them. Often they've been around people that are leading particular projects and not really having a deep, deep, deep insight into how they operate. Because they've always been in investments, and I've lost a lot of money in bad investments.
Yeah.
It depends how deep I go with this, and I don't want to incriminate the people behind it. But there's definitely been there's been bad investments. And it's always been the case of these guys aren't operating. You know, if you really knew how they operate, you would not put your money with them.
And what did it teach you?
I tend to trust too much.
Hmm.
It's taught me to be a lot slower and bring in people around me that are better at reading people. Also ask a lot more questions. And number one is, if it's not my wheelhouse, it's not worth investing. All right. Yeah.
If Bitcoin disappeared tomorrow, what would you spend the rest of your life modeling?
But it's not going to disappear tomorrow.
Well, that answers my question.
This is it's going up forever, Laura. That's my opportunity. If Bitcoin disappeared tomorrow, what would I model next? Well, who's to say I'm going to model anything? This is just this phase.
Mm-hmm.
I'd do nothing. I'd absolutely do nothing. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, great. Maybe a tragedy for the world, and we go into the eye of Mordor and the world's decimated. But let's assume that it's a nice world.
Yeah.
I'm going to live my life. I'm going to listen to some podcasts. Probably won't be about Bitcoin because that's gone. we'll find out what's out there. I'll listen to some business podcasts. I'll spend time with my family. I'd take time off. I'd love it. You know, I'd get back to surfing, do some kiteboarding, take up some snowboarding.
When was the last time you surfed?
Last time I properly surfed was on the verge of when I started doing the Bitcoin analytics stuff. You know, I was still around, but that was when I remember just surfing every day and writing software to bring in market data, and it was great, you know. But yeah, it's been a long time. It's difficult to do that if you need to chase the next paycheck. But I'm fortunate that, you know, Bitcoin's done me well, you know, and even before that, I was an entrepreneur and I had some money, so I had enough runway to hang out and figure it out and see what comes my way. And I think that's probably the more natural way of doing it before we had to chase the paycheck.
Yeah, let it come instead of chasing it.
Yeah.
Tell me about the last time you panicked during a crash.
Okay, it was the world financial crisis, year 2008, and I was betting on the banks to blow up, and I was betting on gold to go to the moon. And I was not a trader, and that was probably my learning to trade. And so I was very heavily playing options market, taking calls and puts. I put puts on banks. That paid. I mean, turns out when banks go bust, the puts pay.
Yeah.
But when the world financial crisis hits, everything goes down. Everything crashes. The only thing that's not going down during a flight to safety is the US dollar. And so all my call options on gold going up was like plummeting. And I'm a big risk taker, you know. I think that's maybe my Chinese genes, because in Hong Kong, everyone loves gambling. I don't like gambling. I like taking risks, though. And so I had a decent portion of my net worth in long positions on gold as it was plummeting. And so I don't know if you call it panic. I was like, wow. Okay, if I wipe this all out, oh, that means there goes my runway. I'm going to get to do this again, you know, like I'm going to do the entrepreneurial journey. I'm going to do this. That'll be, you know, and I'm hungry. And so it was those contemplations. Those were really good days, because when Bitcoin came along, the volatility within Bitcoin was something I was used to because of those options that I was effectively holding. To close that story, like I netted out neutral. The banks paid, the shorting the banks paid, gold going up didn't really pay, and they balanced out. And then gold went on a 4-year bull run to 2012. That was the right bet, but the timing was wrong and I was a noob. And I think also is for Bitcoiners, we like to think it's a hedge on the system. In a crash, Bitcoin's going to go down. It's going to go down hard as being the most sensitive to liquidity. And you want to develop an intestinal fortitude. You want to have your plan in place so that when it bounces, and it's going to bounce, that you're not freaked out. You're not selling your Bitcoin. This is why having a little bit of buffer and not being all in for many people was a good idea. You don't want to be in panic. You want to be like, if these things happen, I've thought about it, and this is my situation, just hold tight. Yeah.
What's your personal signal-to-noise filter?
Yeah, my mind's pretty tunnel vision. It's a little bit automatic. I would say I'm more on the spectrum somewhere, and I'm ADHD, so that tunnel vision comes very, very naturally to me. Where other people have a lot of noise, I'll hone in on signal, because and that signal is always something that is internal to me that I can see very, very clearly. I think it's not important to find what's important, ironically. Like, I'm sure it's all important. It's just how it relates to you. Is this the bit you know, I'm born to understand, and it energizes me? Can I see more of this? And so I don't worry about signal to noise, because maybe it was noise, but no one turned it into signal. Maybe we thought it wasn't important, but it is important, but no one's articulated and seen clearly enough why it's important. And I'm sure all this stuff is important on some level. Yeah.
The smartest Bitcoiner you know.
The smartest Bitcoiner I know. Smartest. I mean, that's a tough one. There's so many smart people in the industry. And there's always someone coming in to give an insight that we haven't seen before. I don't think there is a smartest. And then it's like, what are you going to measure as smart? You know, so you can't measure, like, are we going to do IQ points? Are we going to get, did you get it right? Are you going to do, did you build something great? Or did you help more people? Did you provide more freedom to the world? Did you love your family? Did you maintain your relationships? I mean, intelligence has many, many dimensions. And so, like, I'm sure you point to the IQ part, but even that is like, how do I tell the difference between someone who's like deep inside the consensus mechanism, battle hardening it, and maybe looking at the road ahead, maybe quantum computing is going to be a problem and moving us towards solving those problems, versus someone that's in the markets, in the public markets, and opening up the channel for those large capital flows to come into Bitcoin in so that it's big enough to change the world. How do you compare the two? And so we have a lot of smart people and they're all doing different jobs. And I think that the whole point is not who's the smartest, but, you know, can we get this job done?
Can we?
Yeah, it's inevitable. It's inevitable. I said, like, the smartest people have come in and they came in early. We're just really, really blessed to have like a massively smart community, and I wouldn't pick one over the other, and everyone has their time to shine.
Yeah. Okay, but you have to pick your favorite quote.
The one that gives me the most laugh is, "It's going up forever, Laura." I just love how Michael Saylor is so sure, you know, and he puts it down in such a simple one-liner. And then you've got on the other side Laura Shin, who's so well-researched. And it just, it makes me laugh because I respect both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And just having this one liner pop out there, and it's yeah, so that's one I like the most.
Okay,
because it's funny. Man.
So thanks for sharing, Willie. Mm-hmm. Those were my 21 takes on you. Now let's talk Wonomics.
Okay,
War on X is you sold most of your Bitcoin. Is that true? And if so, why now?
Yeah, it was partially true. In that, you know, I was being provocative. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but I like to say things that are a little bit shocking. That's just me personally. It's not because I'm trying to gamify the system, but I like to say provocative things. And I did sell my Bitcoins in a sense. I rotated it. There's a number of reasons. First, let's talk about self-custody. Bitcoin needs self-custody.
Mm-hmm.
For the system to be robust and impervious to attack from the great pools of capital and the nation states and all that will come in a way, nationalization of the supply, all these attack vectors are defended against by the masses, self-custodying. You want to just quietly stack, buy your Bitcoin, put it into cold storage and don't talk about it. CK, for you, it's too late. You run a podcast. For me, it's too late. For Andreas Antonopoulos, it's too late. You know, I noticed he disappeared off the scene. My theory is he wanted to be private. He said to Roger Ver, "I lost all my coins." Then the community gave him 50 bitcoins, and then he disappeared off the scene. I don't want to disappear off the scene. I feel like there's a lot of work to be done. I think that's probably the contribution I can do, other than other things I could do. That there's, you know, it's been 12 years in the industry now, and I think this industry is just warming up to make some big impact on this world, and so I want to stay on the scene. And so for the people that are public, there's an OPSEC issue after the last bull market. I got too noticed. In terms of even to yesterday, last night, someone said, "Hey, are you Willy Woo?" And I said, "Yeah, see you tomorrow." Assuming he's here in Riga, Latvia to do the Honey Badger OG conference.
Are you wearing a restaurant something?
No, I was on the street. Didn't know it was even on. And the time before that, it was in a supermarket in Hong Kong, and I was with my daughter. And he's asking me, "Oh, you know, just normal personable things. Where does your daughter go to school?" And this was like, yeah. So ultimately, OPSEC is a big part of it. I want Bitcoin to be self-custody by the masses, but for the people that are public, I think there's a trade-off there. And the whales are starting to move to custody solutions. and they have their place, like, for that. The other reason is I want to invest back into the industry. I think that it's at a point where some interesting rail is going to be built for this asset, and this is what I want to invest in. And so I'm an investor in DebiFi because lending has my interest. Coming from the hedge fund world, looking at this, I've been 3.5 years in the hedge fund world. This is my learning inside TradFi. We work with Swiss private banks. I'm coming from technology to Bitcoin to TradFi to learn that. So lending into the space really interests me. I invested in my home country, New Zealand, where I, was raised to help that infrastructure, Lightning Pay New Zealand, so that people there can sats instead of have their bank transactions being blocked by the banks there, and point of sales there to build a circular economy, long-term plan. All these sort of things excite me. And so I want a hand in it. I want to be working with these founders and seeing what their problems are. And yeah, because I'm a startup founder as well, in a past life. And it's cool to see the next generation of founders, and they're doing it in this space with incredible tailwinds. Bitcoin's going to go easily 100, 200x from now, and that's going to be the money. And they just need to be in there and not blow up. If they can find a business that is profitable, it'll do well.
Are ETFs and corporate treasuries making on-chain and technical analysis less reliable?
No. And I would say that ETFs are like a little bit of a red herring. They might give you a little insight of what this cohort is buying, but it misses the picture of the total flows coming into the network, because it turns out ETFs might be on a good day 1/5 of the flows. There's a lot more going outside of the ETFs. So you'll be missing the bigger picture. And if you measure it on chain, it's across the entire network, you're looking at the flows into the ETFs and the flows out of the ETFs. You can see it on chain anyway. So why would you measure this little box here when you can measure the entire system? And what we're measuring in the flows into and out of the ETFs, which is a little box, okay? And then you got MicroStrategy here, is another bigger box, and these flows coming in and out of that. And it's like, that's not where I'm going to draw my box. I'm going to draw the box around the entire system of the flows coming into Bitcoin and out of Bitcoin. Those are both on-ramps that are small and not the full picture. ETFs, public treasury companies, what they are a on-ramp into Bitcoin. Okay, an on-ramp being, a gateway to put your capital and flow it into Bitcoin and buy Bitcoin. We used to wire money from the bank into an exchange and buy it. That's not going to cut it for people that use institutions. The high net worth, the pension funds, the sovereign wealth funds, they're not going to buy Bitcoin in self-custody. Maybe the sovereigns might, but you wanted to handle the keys yourself, or how are we going to handle that? So I'm going to have to build a custody solution. I'm going to build Coinbase custody, any of these custody solutions. That's very, very specialist. And it can't be one person holding the key. It's got to be sharded amongst all the directors or the stakeholders, so that it cannot be stolen, because you have a fiduciary duty to look after this money for your investors. If you have a pension fund, you cannot screw this up. You cannot buy self-custody Bitcoin. You're going to have to absolutely do everything Coinbase custody does. I remember Zippo, back when they were doing custody, bought a vault in a Swiss mountain with armed guards, paper wallet. That's not going to happen. So you can buy an ETF. You can buy MicroStrategy. That's easy. And it's immediate. And so what these publicly traded entities are, ETF and the treasury companies, they are on-ramps such that the very large pools of capital can enter and flow in. So that's good, right? Mm-hmm. That's really, really good, because if Bitcoin's going to go from $2 trillion of market cap to $20, $100 trillion, make a real difference, kill fiat, those pools of capitals have to be coming in and making it big enough. And then the flip side to that is the brittleness it adds to Bitcoin's underlying security model, that when you have these large concentrations of Bitcoin, they can be nationalized by governments. Hey, the US government's done it before. Let's back everything with gold, but now let's run it on US dollars. That's world reserve currency. It's all sitting in Fort Knox in 1971. They failed to honor the redeemability. They snipped it and we have fiat today. So that history can repeat again.
Mm-hmm.
And they have done it before, and it'll be really, really lovely. It'll be like, hey, to bolster the US economy or this, and patriotic, aren't you? We are going to have a big stack of Bitcoin. It's going to be marvelous. So we're going to make a offering to all of the publicly traded companies to buy their shareholding and take majority, and we're going to then nationalize that effectively without using the word. So that could totally happen. That's the flip side of it. And so need to be wary of it, both the risk, but also the things that need to happen such the big pools of capital do come in.
Yeah. Do you think rehypothecation is something happening right now in the market and it's spreading quietly?
Of course it is. Yeah, it is absolutely being, but it's also a common practice, right? It's a very common practice. We had that in the last cycle. It got a little bit contentious with Jack Mallers and Strike, I thought, when like he made the statement with Strike that we won't rehypothecate, and someone pulled up the terms and services and it turned out it did have it in there. And then there was the promise that we're going to rehypothecate only once, right? So the thing is, the way in which the infrastructure works, you generally have to move those coins out to someone who's providing the capital. And the question is, does it then move further?
Yeah.
And the question is, do you have a guarantee that it's not going to be moved again? The original terms of service was, we don't have to even notify you. And you have to be very, very careful in the terms of service when they say, we're going to get you your yield and these people are going to provide the yield, but we might change who's going to basically hold your coins and we don't need to notify you. Okay. The first is, they don't even need to tell you. Second is, obviously, don't trust verify. How can we verify that? And so when you get into the details of what really happens, all these solutions often have ability to rehypothecate legally. It's so much incentive to do that. For example, I want to get more customers in, so I want to give you a better yield. So therefore, I'm going to give it to this guy who's going to give me a yield. But this guy, if I let him rehypothecate down the track, which means going up higher the risk curve, I can get you the higher yield. And so whenever you see a high interest rate, just there's a lot of risk, and there's even more risk of rehypothecation unless you have a private key. If you do have a private key, then you can check it on the blockchain. So you know, and that's why I want to move into that area of lending with like DeFi. That's the start of a whole wave of these types of lenders that can give you a private key, so you can verify, not just trust.
HODL is doing the same, isn't it?
Yeah, DeFi is the same same founder.
Yes, yeah, Max,
and just moving that to institutional liquidity provisioning. HODL is peer to peer. This one is TradFi to Bitcoiners that want to borrow against their Bitcoin.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing, Willie. Where can people follow you and your work?
Okay. So in Twitter's, well, let's call it X now, that's Woonomic, that handle. I think it's pretty well known. Also, you can find me on Substack because we now have like a publication for retail. It's under the Bitcoin Vector, but you can search Willy Woo on Substack as well.
It's been great having you on. Can't wait to have you back in part 2. Until then, stay sovereign.
Okay, thanks, CK, and really enjoyed it.